Study practice retreat is different, obviously, than a silent day of formal meditation. And it's a day of listening and digesting and, for me, going through quite a large amount of material. So it can feel quite full, I think. You know, we spend a lot of hours just absorbing. Don't feel like you need to sort of catch hold of everything, you know, that you somehow need to write notes on everything. I think that there's a curious process, I think, in learning in a different way, you know, that we're not about memorizing, we're not about sort of, trying to remember everything. It's more, I think, what happens when we bring into listening an inner quietude and a receptivity and a curiosity that allows us to listen and for teachings to land. And sometimes they land in ways that feel a little mysterious, you know, it's not because we remember something verbatim. But there's a process of learning that takes place. So as I mentioned yesterday, although I will be the one doing most of the talking, you will be the ones doing the most of the listening. This really is a participatory day. It relies on both of those things coming together. And meditative listening, I think, is a real art. You know, whether it's listening to another person in communication or whether it's listening to a teaching, meditative listening is truly an art. You know, as we learn to kind of calm the mind that, you know, has to get it right, or, you know, has to figure everything out, or has to remember everything. Just allowing that receptivity to be there. Yesterday, many of you were here, but for some of you who weren't, we were exploring one particular discourse. It's actually only a two-page discourse, but we managed to spend 5 or 6 hours exploring it. And the theme of this weekend is really around untangling the tangle, really understanding the way our world of experience is shaped and created, because it is that understanding of the process of that construction, I think, allows us, is a doorway to understanding the ways in which, you know, our times of distress and struggle and conflict are born and how they come into being. And for us to be able to kind of undo some of those patterns of entanglement and the patterns of constructing worlds that we're not sure that we really want to inhabit. For us to have a means of understanding and undoing those tangles, first we need to understand how those tangles and constructions are actually created. This was such an emphasis in the Buddha's time, you know, this emphasis upon understanding as the means to awakening, understanding as the means to liberation. And I think one of the great gifts of the Buddha's teaching was to take a sense of bewilderment out of our lives. You know, sometimes we can end up in places and we wonder how we got there. And sometimes that wondering is followed by the word again. How did I end up here again? You know, in this state of contractedness, or this state of contention, or this state of struggle. How did I end up here again? You know, or sometimes in our life we find ourselves caught in some major obsession or some major emotional or thought storm, and we get spit out the other end, and we sort of look back and we think, what was that all about? And bewilderment is, of course, a place often of helplessness. And what the Buddha suggested is that we can actually look carefully at the processes of our own hearts and the processes of our own minds, and we can trace them. We can trace and track how our world is being born moment to moment. And our capacity to do that through mindfulness and through investigation really kind of shows us the way out. You know, I remember years ago coming out of a retreat in California, and for some bizarre reason I agreed to go shopping with someone. And I found myself in one of these monster department stores, you know, and they're designed so you can't find the exits. You know, you just kind of go in through all of these. They're not even aisles, they're like a maze, you know. And I thought, this it's reminiscent of something, actually. And I discovered, you know, what you really need to do is to keep your eye on the exit sign. Keep your eye on the exit sign. And the Buddha was, I think, a master at teaching us about how to keep our eyes on the exit sign. Not as a process of abandonment or denial or disconnection, but to know that, you know, there are choices other than walking these familiar circles of repetition over and over in our minds and in our lives. You know, in the Tibetan translation of samsara, these kind of wheels of repetition is actually to walk in circles, you know, and a lot of times, too many times maybe, we find ourselves walking in circles. So yesterday I began with just a piece from a small discourse called The Tango, which I want to start with again today, because it, in some ways it frames what we're doing here, this contemplation of mind and contemplation of process. Contemplation of heart and contemplation of process. It goes, a tango within, a tango without. People are entangled in a tango. Gotama, I ask you this, who can untangle this tango? The Buddha answers, a person established in integrity, developing discernment and mindfulness, ardent and clear, they can untangle this tango. Those whose passions, aversion, and ignorance have faded away, for them the tangle's untangled. So today we're going to be exploring another discourse, another sutta from the Pali Canon, from the early teachings, called the Honeyball Sutta. And some of you will be familiar with this discourse because it is actually one of the most important discourses in the entire Pali Canon in describing the cognitive chains of world construction, the cognitive chains that build our world of experience. And I think what for me is often so phenomenal is, you know, psychologists and neuroscience today look at these cognitive chains and say, that's how it works. That's how it works. This is how the mind works. There is a relief, actually, in this investigation because we tend to take our mind so personally, don't we? You know, that this is who I am, you know? I am my mind, I am my world of construction. And as we begin to really investigate and to kind of unpack what's actually going on inwardly, I think what we really encounter is a universal mind. And there's a certain relief in this, you know. It's not all about my mind. You know, last year I came across someone wearing a t-shirt and it had on the written on the front, actually, it really is all about me. And I thought, what a relief it is to discover it really isn't all about me. You know, that this is what the mind can do, and the mind has the great potential to not be entangled. Our hearts and minds resting and understanding have a potential for remarkable clarity, to be a true friend and to be a true ally. And I think one of the great concerns and the great dedications of the Buddhist teaching was to show us a way to cultivate a mind that is a friend, a mind and a heart that really feels like a refuge and an ally. So I think today, like yesterday, we will... it would be great if this wasn't just a one-way street. So I will be taking pause moments when I remember, and these are really times for you to clarify or reflect on anything that feels important for you to do that. And so please don't be shy around that. So today, like yesterday, I'd like to sort of unpack this discourse called the Honeyball Sutta. Now, I often feel it's rather unfortunate that, you know, many people tell me they feel a little bit sort of deterred from reading the discourses or reading the early texts because at first glance they can seem so impenetrable, the language is often a little bit awkward, and they can feel, you know, I mean, you know, if you're looking for a way to go to sleep, you know, they can feel sometimes a little lifeless, you know, a little lifeless. And I think there's a genuine art in learning to bring these texts to life. And it does involve you using a little bit of imagination. Sometimes I think we would be aided almost by somewhat a kind of dramatization of the discourses, you know. We could assign roles and you know, someone could volunteer to be the Buddha, so, you know. But it would actually be helpful because there is something about almost having an image in your mind of what's actually going on here. So what's really important to remember is these discourses are almost always set in a teaching situation. You know, the Buddha was a genuine person. He did not look like that. He was a genuine person, you know, spent much of his life on the road, walking, and stopping to teach. But most of his life was spent walking, and then stopping for a time and really having a teaching time where people would come and ask questions or ask questions that were important for them about their lives. So it's really important to contextualize this. You know, the Buddha was not sitting on a stage like this, you know, static, you know. He was very engaged with the community that he lived in, the life that he lived in. So this discourse, like many discourse, begins with almost bringing to mind the context in which this teaching is offered of the Honeyball Sutta. So what I'll do a bit like I did yesterday and just read a little bit, but remember this first bit is actually setting the stage for this teaching. On one occasion, the Buddha was living in the Sakya country at Kapilavatthu. Then when it was morning, he dressed and taken his bowl and robe, went into Kapilavatthu for alms. So you have that image in your mind. This is something the monks and nuns would do every morning. They would get up, they would take their begging bowl, they would go to the village to receive their food for the day. When he'd wandered for alms in Kapilavatthu and had returned from the alms round, after his meal he went to the great wood for the day's abiding, sat down at the root of a tree. Dandapani, the Sakyan, while walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood. And when he'd entered, he went to the tree where the Buddha was and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous talk was finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick, and asked the Buddha, "What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim?" Now, it's really important to understand that this is actually... Dandapani is actually assuming a position of hostility. Huh? So in almost any other discourse, you know, it would be introduced that somebody goes to ask the Buddha a question and they sit down beside them beside the Buddha, and they have an exchange, they have questions, they have a conversation. So the fact that Dandapani kind of goes to one side, leaning on his stick, and almost says, you know, what do you teach? Okay, so it's already, what's expressed here is a slight attitude of aggression or hostility or argument. So what does the Buddha answer? Friend, I assert and teach such a teaching that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, its brahmins, in this generation, with its recluses and its princes and its people. This is the teaching that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. I'm going to repeat that sentence again. I want you to listen to this very carefully. As friend, I assert and proclaim such a teaching that one does not quarrel with anyone in this world, with its gods, its maras, its brahmas, in this generation, with its recluses and brahmas, its princes, its people, such a teaching that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasure, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. Perceptions no more underlie a person. That's actually the essence of this whole sutta. Does that make sense to you? No, probably not. I mean, please don't feel embarrassed to admit it, you know. I mean, it didn't make sense to you'll see as we go on here, you know. But that single line is the essence of this whole discourse. You know, we could leave it there and go home and think, you know, like everybody else around him, immediately awakened. I listened to that, immediately awakened. Got it all, I'll just go home. Instead, we sit there and think, perceptions no more underlie the person who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. Okay, when this was said, Dandapani, the Sakyan, shook his head, wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered in three lines. Then he departed, leaning on his stick. He was not a happy camper. He didn't find this particularly illuminating. He didn't find this particularly liberating. He didn't actually, you know, just wagged his tongue, whatever that means, you know. Then, when it was evening, the Buddha... Okay, just go back to this word, quarrel. The Buddha's very... stating here, he is no longer in a state of contention with the world. He's no longer in a state of conflict or enmity with anyone in this world. And this word quarrel here, it sounds very light in a way, but it's almost describing the whole range of relational conflict. Relational conflict that can, you know, so haunt and shadow our lives, the kind of enmity or ill will based on misperception, based on confusion, that leads us to feel estranged and apart and at odds with people in our life. And again, like yesterday, although, you know, again, I want to encourage you to take this a little bit personally, although it isn't all about you. I do want you to take it a little bit personally, because it's so important that we place this in the context of our own lives. You know, and we might think right now, you know, where in our lives are we in a state of quarrel? You know, where in our lives are we in a state of alienation or disconnection or estrangement? And what is actually at the root of that? You know, and when we ask that question, of course, we can come up with a very, very long story. But what is at the root of it in this moment? Take the history away. What sustains that state of quarrel for us? And what role is perception playing in sustaining those quarrels? What role is perception, how we see another person, how we perceive another person, how we perceive ourselves? What role is perception playing just now, in this moment, if you bring to mind anybody that you're in a state of quarrel with? What role is perception playing in keeping that alive and fixed and static? Because this is what the Buddha is actually asserting. This whole discourse is actually an exploration of how misperceiving instigates enmity, ill will, disconnection, and estrangement. Okay? So, Dandapani's gone on his way with his stick and his puckered forehead and his wagging tongue. Then, in the evening, the Buddha rose from his meditation, so you get a sense of how the Buddha spent his days. Would walk, arrive somewhere, get up in the morning, go on alms round, sit down, practice, people would come, there would be discussion. And then the evening, the Buddha rose from meditation and went to Nagrodha's park, where he sat down on a seat made ready for him. And he told the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis what had happened with Dandapani. And then a bhikkhu asked the Buddha, "But, venerable sir, what is the teaching that you asserted whereby one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, its brahmas, in this generation, with its recluses and brahmins, its principles, its princes and people?" So being aware in this kind of statement of all of these different people, the Buddha's talking about, I'm not quarreling with anyone. Not the difficult people, the maras. Not the people who are close to me, not the people who are, supposedly superior to me or beneath me. I am not quarreling with anyone, including the difficult. How is it that perceptions no more underlie that Brahmin? This means a noble one, by the way. Don't think of it only as a sort of caste classification. How is it that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures without perplexity, without bewilderment, with shorn of anxiety, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being? So the bhikkhus are, clearly not only Dandapani didn't quite understand what the Buddha was saying. The bhikkhus are saying, what do you mean by this? So the Buddha goes on. He says, "Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, as to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person, if nothing there is found to delight in, to welcome and to hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, the underlying tendency to aversion, the underlying tendency to views, to doubt, the underlying tendency to conceit, the underlying tendency to the desire for being, the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here, these unwholesome states cease without remainder." So the Buddha fleshed out that first pithy little statement. So what he is saying, that perceptions, when they are triggering and shaded by underlying tendencies, perception will be distorted, misshaped, and be the source of enmity, quarrel, fighting, false speech, and all of the hostility that is found in the world. And the Buddha says, this can end and cease without remainder. Okay, so that's a bit more fleshed out. So it's still, you might be sitting there thinking, how does this all work? So let's unpack it a little bit. Don't be intimidated. You don't have Blue Peter in America, but in England we have Blue Peter. It's a kid's show, and somebody always pulls out something that they made earlier. You know, so here, this is what I made earlier. Could you do me a favor and just twist that around just slightly so I can see it? The easel. Thanks. Okay. The source through which perceptions and notions, tinged by mental proliferation, beset a person. If nothing there is found to delight in, welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust and all of these other underlying tendencies that I've written on the bottom of the board. Now, the word in Pali for underlying tendencies is anusyas. Now, it's often translated as underlying tendency, but I'm told the more accurate translation are the obsessions that we lie down with. The obsessions that we lie down with. Isn't that something? I find that really kind of eye-opening. What are the obsessions we lie down with? The patterns that we lie down with. And then this is what I'm going to ask you to take a little bit personally. You know, look at this bottom list. Lust, aversion, views, doubt, conceit, the desire for becoming, to be a certain kind of person or a certain kind of experiences, the desire for non-becoming, the desire not to be the kind of person who has another kind of certain kind of experience, and ignorance. This is where we have a more universal map. I mean, can you think of any obsessions that you lie down with that are outside of this particular list? I mean, that there may be kind of nuances, you know, there may be sort of, slight sidetracks, it may have a particular narrative, but can you think of any obsessions that you lie down with? I love that phrase, you know, the obsessions that this is where I visit a lot, you know, this is where I kind of make frequent visitations, you know. These are the obsessions I lie down with. Can we think, look at our own minds, look at our own circles that we walk in. Can you think of any obsessions that we lie down with that are not under the umbrella of this particular list? It'd be good if you can. I'm not saying there aren't any. The conceit that is here is actually mana, which is probably what you're referring to. The conceit of self, it is a relational conceit, where I am picturing myself in relationship to another person as being better than them, worse than them, or the same as them. Yes?
Would addictions fall under aversions?
Well, addictions actually come under lust.
Oh, under lust.
Lust is not obviously just referring to sexual lust. It's psychological, emotional, seeking for satisfaction outside of ourselves.
The ego comes under the view.
Ego comes under, ego is not I'm sorry, I forgot about the underlying tendency of ignorance, which is about covers them all anyway. Ego is not a particularly Buddhist concept. You know, this is a much later introduction. Because, you know, as I talked about yesterday, the whole idea of self as a process of selfing being shaped and formed actually on the basis of these underlying tendencies. These are what shape our sense of who we are. These are our house builders. This is the landscape of our self-view. You know, so the whole sense of selfing is actually far more a composite that is born of some variation of this entire list.
Is ignorance used at the bottom the same as the ignorance at the top?
It is indeed, because this is not a one-way street. This is a circular process. So ignorance is certainly one of those underlying patterns that gets triggered to the surface. I'm going to just look at how that happens. But ignorance is also the ground, you might think of it as a ground, upon which this whole process is unfolding in a particular way that causes argument and suffering. Yes? No. Perception is something quite different than obsession. Anousias is the underlying tendency. But the effect of the anousias is to distort perception.
Okay, so then perception by itself, is that always a problem?
Absolutely not.
Okay,
so it's a good place to just introduce that bit, because perception, the word in Pali is sanya. This discourse is all about the role that perception plays, distorted perception plays, in shaping argument and quarrel and conflict, okay? Now, it's very clear to us in our life that perception is always going to be part of a psychological process of being functional in this world. You know, to get through our day, we need perception. It is what enables us to actually move in this world in some kind of sane way. You know, it is perception. Remember, perception is a way, actually, that we organize and recognize the world. This is how, I know this is a table, that's perception, you know. And because I have navigational perception, I have enough information to know to sit on the chair rather than sitting on the glass of water, because I know what a chair is. And I know what a glass of water is. So navigational perception will always be part of a cognitive chain, and it is part of functionality in the world. In itself, it is quite neutral. Perception is ethically neutral in itself. It is what I call navigational perception. In a way, it does help us just simply to organize the world in a way that makes sense and the way that we can then relate to it. Okay? Now, perception that is affected by the anousias, the underlying tendencies, is also organizing the world, but it's organizing the world emotionally. It's organizing the world according to the underlying tendencies. So when perception is triggering the underlying tendencies, I see the world through those underlying tendencies, and my recognition of the world and how I relate to it is through that distorted perception that's distorted by the underlying tendencies. So the world gets organized into friends and enemies. Things that are beautiful, things that are ugly, things that I fear, things that are desirable for me to have. Things that affirm me, things that challenge me. Now, think of some examples of this. You know, we hear it, don't we? We go outside, you know, perhaps we, you know, we're on our way here, you know, we drive through, you know, the warehouse district, you know, oh, this is ugly, you know, I don't want to be here. It's already distorted. It's already distorted. It's not as it is. I see somebody that I met 10 years ago, you know, that I had some argument with, and there's that miserable person, you know. Perception is already distorted by the underlying tendencies. I walked down the street and I smelled the baking bread, you know, and oh yeah, I'm going to hang out here. It reminds me of Mom's kitchen, you know, and oh, my wonderful child. Just perception is already being, the world is being organized emotionally through the play of our underlying tendencies. And this is happening so quickly, and we accept the authority of that emotional organization of what is good and bad, what is lovely and what is unlovely, who is my friend, who is my enemy, what is attractive, what is ugly. We accept the authority of that emotional organization, and we act on the basis of that acceptance. What we avoid, what we go for, who we will accept, who we will disdain, how this applies to our view of ourselves. Is this quite clear? This is actually the essence of that teaching. And this besets us. I like that word, and it talks about besets us. Perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person. Doesn't it just feel like it all just happens to you? That this is just kind of falls upon us, uninvited. You know, there's that wonderful quote that says, you know, most people really believe that their minds are something like a mirror, more or less accurately reflecting the world as it actually is, not appreciating that the mind is a principal element in the creation of that world. We say, this is how it is. This is how it is. I'm sorry, you had a question.
Well, I'm just thinking about emotions being affected or tinged by the underlying tendencies. Emotion free of underlying tendency, is that a pure emotion?
There isn't a word in Pali for emotion. I have to say that. Which actually sounds kind of strange, because certainly from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, you know, emotions are a compound.
What?
A compound. You know, they're a compound that includes somatic experience, will include thought, will often include association, will often might include underlying tendencies, but they might include wholesome patterns also, you know. But there isn't a word in Pali for emotion, because they're always a compound process. A process that's being shaped by a whole range of different factors. You know, so there's no independence of existence and emotion. There's a process of emotions being shaped both by the skillful and by the unskillful. Okay, are we sort of quite clear so far? Okay, we'll go on. What is the Buddha is basically saying? That as long as the anusyas, which are actually, you have to see this continuum, they are actually a byproduct. The anusyas, these obsessions we lie down with, are a kind of outflow of ignorance, of avidya, of not seeing things clearly. You know, when we speak about avidya or ignorance, it often feels like a vague concept because, you know, where is it? You know, how do I know? You know, we actually don't know that there's avidya until it's triggered into the surface in the shape of the anusyas, or these obsessions we lie down with. Those anusyas then are perception is you know, perception through the eye, through the sense doors is triggering those anusyas. The anusyas are shaping how we see, hear, feel, think, touch. Okay, we'll go into this. And the reason that the Buddha is emphasizing this is because he is really interested in how suffering and quarrel arises and how suffering and quarrel comes to an end. So this is a very major piece of teaching and understanding the construction of distress and the ending of distress. Okay, because as the Buddha says, when the ending of the underlying tendencies. This is the end of conflict. But there was a sentence in there in the beginning of this paragraph that I think we need to just spend a little bit of time with, if that's all right with you. The source through which perceptions and notions, colored and tinged by mental proliferation, beset a person, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold on to, this is the end of the underlying tendencies. If nothing is found there to delight in, to welcome, and to hold on to, this is, raises, I think, quite a big question about our infatuation with our narratives and constructions. Our reluctance sometimes to relinquish narratives and constructions even when they're painful. You know, never mind when they're pleasant. I mean, I could have, you know, if I cast my mind back in the past and bring forth people who've offended me in some way or other, you know, the image immediately triggers, you know, the narrative comes with the image, you know. And do I delight in it? Do I welcome it? Do I hold on to it? What is it that keeps our constructions in place apart from delighting, welcoming, and holding on to them? So I think the first thing the Buddha is asking of us is to question our enchantment with some of our constructions and our stories and our narratives, because this is keeping them going. This is keeping them going. It's the fuel that's keeping them in place. Even when it's a quarrel, even when it's an estrangement, a conflict, still it's kept alive and repeated and repeated and kept in place simply because of our relationship to the narrative when it arises. And isn't it strange how sometimes, you know, it's almost slightly understandable that we might want to welcome, delight in, and hold on to pleasant constructions. You know, that's slightly more understandable, perhaps, because it, you know, does do a little bit of self-assertion here, and it can feel sort of like fun, and, you know, I really like that fantasy, and I really like that story. What we see is that the tendency to delight in, welcome, and hold on to does not have the freedom of selection. If that tendency is alive and we're thinking, okay, well, okay with the pleasant, not with the un, it doesn't have the freedom of selection. It's a pattern, it's a habit that will be shared equally with the pleasant and the unpleasant constructions. Yeah. And the Buddha talks a lot about sort of breaking the spell of that enchantment, of holding, of welcoming, delighting in that which is actually serving to almost sustain estrangement and sustain a kind of disconnection and dissociation from the present. The Buddha is really asking us to really look at what is going on there that sustains the quarrels and even sustains the disconnection from the present through the infatuation with the pleasant constructions. I mean, I think that's a real... It's kind of an important question. Because it's the first step. It's like if we don't question what keeps something stuck in place, the delighting in, the welcoming, and the holding on to, we're not going to get to that point where we actually can see the process of how the construction is happening. You know, and then we will continue to create new constructions and new narratives that we will delight in, welcome, and cling to, that will be part of the baggage of our lives. It's just making sense to you. Mm-hmm. Okay, just a pause moment. Any thoughts about just that first bit, the delighting, the welcoming, and the holding to? Yes, please.
You said the sutta, doesn't it start out as an imperative? You know, we have like some valuation of that just automatically because it's a story.
We're talking about something quite different here. This is meant to be a teaching story, so it's not something to actually hold on to. You know, it's not my narrative. It's not featuring that kind of self-centralization. Whereas the constructions that we're talking about that create quarrel and create conflict clearly have that centralized selfing within them. It's supposed to be a narrative that leads to the end of quarrel.
Thinking about our Western tendency to quarrel and have conflict with ourselves.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, is that...
It's no different.
It's no different.
It's no different. It's no different. I mean, here the Buddha is speaking about the nature of a quarrel being constructed. You know, and that would be the same inwardly and as it is outwardly. That kind of same sense of argument, of conflict. Then it's not, where it lands, it doesn't matter. It's more the pattern of actually creating it. And it is, as you say, exactly the same.
There's no freedom of selection.
No, there's no freedom of selection.
And it seems like it makes so much sense why we don't give up suffering. Because we don't want to give up the good stuff. I mean, and if that's, you know, I know that it's much deeper than that.
But it's a very important point. Because sometimes we're imagining we have in these patterns to welcome, delight, and cling to a freedom of selection. And we're imagining somehow, you know, we've got this menu that says, I'll only cling to the pleasant and delight in the pleasant and not in the unpleasant. The menu is not there. The menu, it's a set meal. Isn't it? There isn't choice on the menu, you know. If I'm going to welcome, delight, and cling to, it does not have that freedom of selection. And that's such an important point, because we want to tell ourselves that it's okay here, but it's only okay when it feels good. And then it's not okay when it doesn't feel good. That is part of that momentum, for sure, that keeps that pattern going. That's kind of a self-delusion. Yes, it is really true. Yeah.
I'm not sure if I can express this, but we have this with individuals and with ourselves and relationships, but we also are kind of, we have the news and we have all this stuff coming at us that we have these reactions to. Is this part of that kind of...
Absolutely, because I think what the Buddha is pointing out to, again, just to reiterate it, is the process of constructing quarrel and enmity and dispute. We do this individually and we can do it collectively. You know, we can do it as a culture, we can do it as an ethnicity, we can do it as an identity. We can do it collectively. And actually almost the collective construction almost seems to be more convincing than my individual one. Look, everybody else has the same view. Must be right. Must be right. Yeah.
Seems like the underlying cause would be, it's a matter of trust.
Yes, but I think in this you're also talking about the psychological process of selfing, you know, very much. I mean, clearly as human beings, you know, we long and we are benefit from safety, from acceptance, from closeness, from intimacy. You know, as human beings on that very personal level, of course we benefit from that. But we've turned that into a craving. You know, and we often seek to satisfy that craving, unfortunately, in ways that it can't be satisfied. You know, and I think that the Buddha was very clear on honoring those very wholesome aspirations, those very wholesome desires and longings, but to put them in the right place. You know, to put them in the right place, because, you know, so often again, you know, we are seeking that somehow we're going to find that in some kind of reliable, guaranteed way, within someone else or within a certain situation. I mean, there's one discourse where the Buddha says this, and you know, don't take this as being kind of cold or dissociative, but he said, why would I, a being who is changing, who is endlessly subject to impermanence and instability, why would I, as a being who is held within the rhythm of impermanence, imagine that I'm going to find safety and stability in that which is also subject to aging, birth, aging, sickness, death, and change? Yes, please.
So I'm
sorry, I'm not reframing the questions. Please, when I don't do this, wave your hands at me if you can't hear the questions. Yes, please.
So I think for, like, I'm getting a concept of, like, the groundlessness and the ground that we construct ourselves on, and that perception of groundless, nothing to hold, no me. I mean, it's just really, with this part of it in place, of how we construct, it's making so much more sense to me what that term actually means.
Okay, so the question is around ground and groundlessness, you know, and it is true that perception, emotional, perception flavored by these underlying obsessions we lie down with, or these anicias, is it not only a way of emotionally organizing the world, but it's emotionally organizing the world to make it look safe and predictable and certain. There is an underlying impulse within those obsessions. It is our endeavor as human beings to make the world familiar in our emotional, it's not even right to say emotional organization, but it's to make the world familiar through exerting, through the perception being influenced by these patterns. We're actually learning to navigate the world in terms of what is safe, what we believe to be safe, what we don't believe to be safe, what we feel to be acceptable, away from what we feel to be unacceptable. So it's a constant endeavor to create ground, a sense of ground, where I am somehow unassailable, imagining that I am going to be protected by the obsessions that I lie down with. We're in trouble already. Please. Yeah. So what's being asked is you know, how this kind of perception, I mean, the job of perception is to know, but the job of distorted perception is to make the world relationally known according to what I like, dislike, my views, my doubts, my conceit. It's to make the world relationally known to protect us from that fear of not knowing or groundlessness. I mean, it's so interesting if you explore this in your experience. I was staying with Ellen. I said to her, you know, yesterday morning I woke up, and I've had this many times when I travel, I wake up and I don't know where I am. And, you know, perception's just not working. It, you know, there's sights and there's sounds and there's sensations, but there is no organization. And I always find that a wonderful space. You know, the perception is not working. It's just lying there in this space of not knowing. And I also realize when I don't know where I am, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I have actually no purpose. Because I don't know where I am, you know. And also, if I don't know where I am and I don't know what I'm doing, I also actually don't know who I am. You know, I'm just living in this kind of pre-formation state. It's so interesting, this pre-formation state, you know. And then looking, you can see the world start to get organized, you know. Oh, I recognize those windows. I'm in Seattle. Oh, I don't know what I'm doing in Seattle. You know, and I know who I am doing what I'm doing in Seattle. My world has all just come together. It's amazing. It's just like that the world has just come together, you know, and there I am. Now, that is navigational perception. That's absolutely fine. Think of perception shaped by the anusias. Oh, I'm in Seattle. Oh, I've got to go teach today. I wonder if I'm together, you know. A conceit of self would come in, or I'm not quite sure I like it down there, you know, I'm getting aversion, some coming in, you know, oh, no, I wonder why I'm going home, I've got some really good waiting for me, and a little bit of lust coming in, you know, maybe I'm not together, you know, a little doubt coming in, you know, my world, you know, so there's that crossroads. It can just be a functional organizational perception, or it can be an organizing according to the obsessions that I lie down with, and they won't be news to me. Huh? I'm not going to be surprised and think, "Oh, gosh, doubt! Never seen doubt before." They're going to be the obsessions I lie down with. They're going to be the familiar territory. So you can almost see the potential in that, from that transition from the simply navigational perception that's going to get me through my day just fine. And then, or moving into this world of perception that is emotionally organizing and making the world familiar in a particular way according to the anusias. Yeah.
It's an awesome hearing that the knowing, false knowing, creates boundaries.
False knowing creates boundaries? Preformation state. It's a very sophisticated term, by the way. Just made it up. Preformation abiding. Preformation abiding, think of that. And of course, it creates boundaries. The moment the anusias come in, because we're repeating the same. Do you see that? We're repeating what we have repeated in the past. So the moment that anusias are coming into perception, we cannot see anything anew. We cannot respond anew. And we're relieved of the burden of needing to respond anew, because I have made the world familiar to me, and then I know how to react to that world. I know who I am in that world. I know what to expect of you. So I can't see anything anew, because those anusias are constantly replaying historical patterns and superimposing them on the present, so everything is familiar and known. And that in itself, of course, is a boundary, because unless I can see something anew, I'm not stretched to respond differently. I'm not stretched to question what is actually going on. So the anusias, you know, their pattern is locking us into a world of familiarity, both in how we see and perceive, how we react. Have you ever had somebody come to you and say, "I know you"? Oh, doesn't that feel like a bit restrictive? And yet, isn't this what perception flavored by the anusias is actually doing moment to moment? I know you. I know this place. I know this event. Huh? It's I know you. It is removing the possibility of surprise. Huh? It's removing the possibility of being surprised. Huh? Of seeing something I knew. And it is so perverse in a way in our minds that we seek the safety of not being surprised, because we equate surprise with groundlessness or, you know, uncertainty or having to respond in some way we've never responded before. And yet at the same time, we know that our capacity to deepen as a human being and to deepen in our relationships and our way of being in this world relies upon us being able to be surprised. when the person comes to the door who's irritated me 10 years ago, the moment I say, there's that miserable critter, I am saying, I know you. And I don't need to respond any differently to that person than I did 10 years ago. Because my anusyas are right there with the I know you. You know, the aversion might not feel so raw, but it is built, woven into the I know you. And that person's not allowed to change. William Blake once said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. Hmm? When the doors of perception are clouded by the anusyas, the world appears as finite. As finite. Okay. Well, good so far? Good. Okay, so this is a good time, I think so.
So basically, simple term that all our behavior and thoughts just starts there.
Yes. Yes, all our behavior and our thoughts begin with perception, whether it is navigational, skillful perception, but here we're actually speaking about distorted perception, perception distorted by the obsessions we lie down with. Okay, so to continue, and I just want to rewind again to the beginning of this one passage because it is so pivotal in this teaching. And as we do so, please don't make this abstract or conceptual. Please do apply it to your own experience. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, as to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person, if nothing there is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, the underlying tendency to aversion, the underlying tendency to views and conceit, the underlying tendency to the desire for being, and the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here these unwholesome states cease without remainder. This is actually talking about the end of suffering. These underlying tendencies, I think it's really helpful to get familiar with this landscape of the obsessions that we lie down with. You know, they are not, although they could be treated separately, you know, we might find that we specialize. And it is quite useful to get familiar with our areas of specialization. You know, what in this list of tendencies or obsessions do we find ourselves mostly dwelling upon or revisiting or coloring our landscape? Lust is this whole externalization of happiness, of delight, of safety that leads us to pursue both psychological experiences and, of course, material experience, aversion, that landscape of irritation, vexation, jealousy, hatred, views, our statements of authority, doubt, all of our uncertainties, our lack of confidence, our questioning in a wavering way all things. Conceit, the ways with we compare ourselves, see other people, see ourselves as better or worse or the same as, the desire for becoming, the desire for non-becoming, and of course ignorance. What the Buddha is saying, as long as these patterns, these obsessions are in play, they do lead us to interact with the world in a certain way. these are the patterns that directly lead, for example, to violence, to quarrels, to argument, to blame and shame, to malice, wishing harm upon another, to false speech, the ways that we might slander or malign another person, not even acknowledging our own aversion or our own conceit, and how when these tendencies come to an end, so does the suffering born of these tendencies. Now here we have a little mind map, and I think it's useful to, you know, it's just one of the many mind maps that the Buddha talks about. But sometimes it's quite useful to have a mind map, to have almost a visual element that we can kind of trace in our own experience. We think of avidya and ignorance, confusion, this sort of carpet, the ground upon which this creation of suffering is occurring. The anusyas, these patterns that we have sometimes accumulated through a lifetime, you know, sometimes they're generational. Sometimes they've been patterns that have been imprinted upon us by how we've been treated or related to by others. You know, if in our life we've been consistently told that we are incapable or inadequate, it's very likely that we will create a conceit of self where we see ourselves as being lesser or inferior to others. You know, we may have constantly been sort of undermined, and doubt becomes our familiar pattern. You know, so it is not all, I think this is very important to recognize, this is not all inwardly generated, because we don't live in isolation. That many of these patterns or these obsessions are formed relationally with others, with our culture, with the stories we've been told, the stories we tell ourselves, through life experience. There is a formation of certain familiar places of dwelling, familiar coloring patterns, you know, that we find ourselves operating with in our lives. It's very important to recognize this, because sometimes when we talk about the, you know, obsessions and tendencies, you know, how quickly the mind, particularly in the conceit of self, moves into self-blame, you know, and it's what I've done wrong, what I haven't seen clearly, and somehow it's all my fault. But these patterns, of course, are co-created in so many ways. And they interact, you know, they're very, very interactive patterns. You know, the conceit of self, you know, may lead to seeing ourselves lesser than others, may lead to a lot of aversion and fear and defensiveness. You know, it may lead to the patterning or the obsession of the desire to be someone else, to be someone other than who we are, who has a different set of life experiences. It might lead to the desire for non-becoming. How do I make this experience go away? How do I annihilate this way of being in the world, which may very well lead to lust and to greed, for craving for certain kinds of experiences. So it's very important to see the interactive nature of all of this. But when we can be fairly certain, and I think trace in our own experience, that when these patterns are in existence, they pattern perception. They pattern how we see the world. They pattern how we see ourselves. So basically, we are seeing or perceiving through the eyes of these anusyas, or these underlying tendencies. You know, I'm sure this is obvious to you. You know, and if we do it often enough, we often classify ourselves as a type. You know, I'm a greed type, or I'm an aversion type, you know, or I'm a doubt type, because we know the obsessions we lie down with, and that's how we see the world, in the very selective perception. You know, if I see myself as being an aversion type, I'd probably come to that conclusion because I very rarely see anything good going on. You know, if I see myself as a greed type, I'd probably come to that conclusion because I'm always on the prowl for something. You know, so it's kind of borne out how perception becomes so selective. Now, this next step, it says in the discourse, through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person. So here we are moving into this next step of, you know, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this Pali word, prapancha. It's, if you're going to learn one Pali word, this is really a good one. You know, prapancha just sort of rolls off the tongue, you know. And if you're not familiar with the Pali word, you are most likely familiar with the experience of prapancha. And if we would translate prapancha, it is the proliferation or generation of thoughts based on underlying views and patterns that distorts our capacity to see things as they actually are. Got that? So prapancha is easier. It's the cascades of thinking. It's the obsessive thinking. It's the ruminations. It's the narrative building. It's the storytelling that can seem to go on and on, where one thought seems to trigger another 1,000 thoughts. I mean, one translation of prapancha is to spread out. It's to spread out. So the way that even a single thought can spread out into 1,000 thoughts, you know, and that's the world we live in moment to moment often in our life. You know, Paul Brock's a neuroscientist and says, you know, human beings are storytelling machines. You know, and we think we are telling the story, but the story is telling us. The story is telling us who we are. The story is telling us how life is. We are not telling the story. The story is telling us, shaping our world moment to moment. Now, prapancha has the threads. Prapancha carries the threads of the underlying tendencies or the anusiyas. So prapancha is not kind of emotionally neutral. It is almost the vehicle through which these underlying tendencies are beginning to find form in a narrative. You like, you know the aversion story? You know, it's like, and prapancha, I mean, classically, it has three threads. Craving-based prapancha, view-based prapancha, and mana or conceit-based, conceit of self-based prapancha. Now, classically, prapancha carries those three threads. So craving-based prapancha includes, you know, all our fantasies, our excited planning, our imaginings of the better moment, the things that we want and what it's going to deliver for us, you know, the ideal relationship, the ideal person, the ideal body, the ideal car, you know, all of that kind of proliferation about, you know, what we're going to get that's going to satisfy us, where we're going to go that's going to make us happy, the people who are going to delight us. So this is all craving-based prapancha. It's about what is not here. It's about what we want or feel that we need that is not here. Now, view-based prapancha will just take part in any election process. You know, view-based prapancha, you know, what the world needs, who we are, you know, what we assert, you know, what we represent, you know, the way everything is, the way people are, the way life is, you know, the way this group is, the way the world is. This is all view-based prapancha, you know. We have a lot of it. We have a lot of it. And we think in terms, and we think of argument and brawls, how much conflict in this world is a clash of views. That you actually see the world differently than me. You have a view of life that is different than mine. conceit-based papancha, or conceit of self-based papancha. This is our self-narrative that actually gets spread out to the narratives that we have about others, because our self-narrative is always relational. It doesn't stand alone. So this is a story we tell ourselves about who we are, what we are capable of, what we are incapable of, what is possible for us, what is impossible for us. You know, one sees it in so many situations, of course, because it's relational. It's a story I have about who you are and what you're capable of and what you mean to me and what you can offer to me in terms of support or threat or any of those things. We spend a lot of time in this particular domain of papancha, this self-measuring, self-criticizing, self-exaggerating, the story of me that gets told and retold. Now, I tend to, I've taken a certain amount of liberty here, and I would add another two threads of papancha to this classical list. And not that they're not sort of some way included in these, but because they have a different narrative tone. And I would include craving-based papancha proliferation classically includes aversion-based papancha. But I think it's worth making a subtext here for aversion-based proliferation narrative, because it has a very different tone to it, a very different tenor to it than all the things I want that I don't have and need and have to get. Aversion-based papancha has a different tone to it, doesn't it? It's a story we tell about what we dislike and what's not good enough and what we hate and what we're judgmental of and how we dwell in that and how, you know, it has that tone that tone of ill will, that tone of quarrel. And the other thread of papancha that I would tend to include would be bhaya papancha or fear anxiety based papancha. Because bhaya papancha or fear anxiety based papancha, because this also has its own particular tone to it and its own particular way of perceiving, doesn't it? Because when fear-based papancha is operating, you know, we see how perception is so selective. We see the threat around us, the danger around us, the things that we have to do to avoid that threat, the worry, you know, the anxiety about the futures, the rehearsals, the planning. Again, it has its own really specific, I think, tenor or tone to it. So the distorted perceptions trigger this proliferation. Again, the person walks through the door who's upset me. And it's not just seeing, is it? It's, oh, there, first of all, there's the knowing, the distorted perception, distorted by underlying patterns. There's the person who's so miserable. And then that triggers the aversion-based papancha about all the things I don't like about them and why they're miserable, you know, and what they should do to improve themselves and, you know, how they need to change in order to be acceptable, you know, and how do I get away from them. You know, so the distorted perceptions are triggering the papancha. I walk out in the car park and I, you know, see a car I covet, you know. Again, it's not just seeing. Seeing is going to trigger, what do I need to do to get that car, you know, what kind of plans do I have to make, you know, and how come it's not fair that they have that car and I don't have that car, you know. So we bring in a little conceit of self into the mix and we spin. It's often a kind of vertigo. You know, papancha is a kind of vertigo. We spin within it. We get lost within it. And the thing is that this is, again, not a sort of linear process. It's really important to see how the spinning of papancha is feeding back to the perception, isn't it? It's solidifying the distortion in that perception. Because I've spun that wheel of why that person is so miserable and everything about them that's wrong, the next time I see that person, it's even more solidified. So it's solidifying that distortion. And then that is also feeding back to solidify the underlying obsession or pattern of aversion or of desire for non-becoming, the desire for the non-becoming of that person. I'd like them to disappear. I'd like them to disappear. So can you see this process of world construction? Can you see how this happens so quickly? And again, sometimes how enchanted we are by it, you know, simply because we get so lost and so captivated by it. And this is our world of the moment that leads too often, you know, in extreme cases to violence, but to quarrels, estrangement, to suffering, to argument, to dispute, to wrong speech, you know, to a sense of just being imprisoned. So here the Buddha's really describing, in a way, we could call it the problem, we're calling it the kind of the pathos of human beings, you know, this is the calamity we find ourselves in. So we're starting to unpack the bewilderment, we're starting to begin to track what is actually going on here, to begin to see that this process is traceable. And it's never too late. It's almost developing the literacy inwardly that we can track our own cognitive chains, that we can track our own world of constructing and begin to see it and begin to be able to have that literacy. And then there is the possibility of something else coming in, rather than just the vertigo and the sense of just being imprisoned by this whole. You know, it's interesting, the title of this sutta, the honey ball, you know, it's both used very positively and it's used to describe almost the attractive element of this tangle, the enchantment that we can have with it. It's a good pause moment.
As one of the basic understandings of the second moment
of the causes of suffering.
Yes.
Absolutely. It's actually not causes of suffering is not actually the right translation of the second noble truth. It should be the origins of suffering, because it's not necessarily causes, it should be the origins of suffering, of struggle, of discontent. What are the origins?
And the difference between cause and origin?
Cause makes it almost too deterministic. Okay? It makes it almost predetermined. It's not a cause, it's an origin. So the origin of suffering, you know, it's so very often in the Four Ennobling Truths, it's just translated as tanha. But actually when we look under tanha, there's a whole subtext, and this is part of that subtext. Yeah.
You referred to doubt and uncertainty. What about insecurity?
I think you know. So the question is, what about insecurity? How is it different from doubt and uncertainty? Insecurity is likely to be a mixture of doubt and anxiety and aversion and the desire for becoming. It's most likely a compound pattern. Yes, Anna.
Avijja, ignorance. Is it safe to think of that as not seeing the three characteristics, seeing wrongly? Is that a good question?
So the question is around avijja. Is it correct to place this in terms of not seeing the three characteristics of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, anicca, and anatta, non-self? That is certainly part of the big fabric of anicca. You know, you often read in the Buddha's teachings, or you hear in teaching, you know, seeing things as they actually are. You know, which often sounds almost like a statement of ideology. But seeing things as they actually are, I mean, seeing things through the, in the light of dukkha, of change and of non-self. But avidya also includes those four distortions that I was talking about yesterday. Seeing the permanent in, seeking for the permanent in the impermanent, seeing self where there is non-self, seeing the unlovely as being lovely. So, you know, so it includes this kind of distortions which are actually built into distorted perception. Yeah. I'm going to see how, well, the question is about how this relates to the teaching on dependent arising, or Paticca Samuppada again, which is one of those core teachings. What we will do this afternoon is going into actually this cognitive chain, which is a subsection of dependent arising. So they're very closely aligned.
Okay.
Very closely aligned. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I see too, that on the paper it looks, you know, deconstruction is pretty easy, but and when it's happening so fast, it's hard to deconstruct.
And in this, you know, the question is, it, you know, on paper it looks pretty easy. In reality, experientially, it's happening so fast that it's hard to deconstruct. This is why the Buddha encouraged us to practice. In reality, you know, to practice, to slow the process down, to begin to develop the vocabulary, begin to develop the literacy. And this is why the cognitive understanding of this is actually so important. This is a map. This is a mind map, you know. But it's not a static map. You have to think of this as being something very alive, very dynamic, that's happening moment to moment. When we begin to slow the process down, we're actually coming more and more to those pre-formation abidings I talked about earlier, you know, where there is some quietude and some stillness inwardly in which we can listen, and we begin to, and this is not just talking about formal sitting, by the way, this is cultivating that quietude, receptivity inwardly, where we begin to actually sense this forming. Here is the, almost like the genesis of this world, of this moment. You know, and that's what we will talk more about this afternoon, is kind of another mind map that actually is also, because you have to think this as a practice map. You have to think of this as a kind of experiential investigation. You know, we take the cognitive into the experiential investigations. Where do I see this? Well, you know, we don't have to look very far, do we? You know, we start to get notice. Papancha, for example, that's not hard for us to find, you know? A few thoughts in a row. It's not hard for us to find. Eh? We can spend a lot of our life in papancha, simply lost in it. And we start to begin to tease out what are the underlying patterns that's fueling that papancha. You know, so we bring a little bit of investigation to it rather than the delight in welcoming and clinging. We turn that into investigation. Ah, this is kind of like a little signal for me. This is an alarm bell here that I'm somehow, there's something I'm not seeing so clearly. So the moment that we actually begin to get in touch with that proliferation, we pause and we say, ah, okay, well, what's actually going on here? This is the Buddha's constant question, you know. What is actually going on here? You know? So we're turning infatuation into investigation. We begin to look at, okay, what's pushing this particular narrative cycle? You know? And maybe, you know, some things are good to really integrate and memorize and learn, you know, and this kind of landscape of these anusiyas, these obsessions, we start to, it's not always that big news to us really, about what the obsessions are that we specialize in and lie down with a lot, you know. Ah, then maybe we actually maybe even go to a somatic sense of how is that particular anusya manifesting, you know. What does doubt feel like? You know, what does lust feel like? You know, what does aversion feel like? So we're beginning to slow the process down even more. Then we're beginning to see, you know, beginning to calm that. We begin to see how that changes how we're seeing, how that changes our perception mode. So it's not so locked and it's not so reified and it's not so solidified anymore. So it's so important, you know, to bring the cognitive learning, which is really helpful to have these mind maps. Well, at least I find it extraordinarily helpful, you know. It also depersonalizes it all a little bit, you know, because you have to see that the anusyas, the underlying tendencies, are self-builders. You know, if we look at our view of self, it's probably a collection of anusyas. That's kind of startling. I'm just going through life, you know, as a collection of anusyas. Well, that's, you know, every time there's an identification with a view of self, it's most likely I'm just marching through life as a sort of collection of anusyas. Well, it's kind of refreshing. But we only march through life as a collection of anusyas as long as the tendency to cling and to delight in is fostered. And the moment that tendency to cling and to delight in is turned into investigation, we are no longer marching through life as a collection of anusyas. That's even more refreshing. Because these are self-builders. This is how view of self or conceit of self is actually formed and reified. You know, and there is, it's really an interesting question. Where is the sense of self apart from the anusyas? That's quite useful. Yes, please.
Yesterday I was asking a question about identity.
Yeah.
And you said that today you would be interested in that. Would you say that what you were just describing would be somewhat interesting when I was asking?
Absolutely. I mean, what is the difference between identity and view of self? You know, view of self is how I identify myself. Again, it's a distorted perception, isn't it? A view of self is a distorted perception, and a view of self is actually distorted through the play of the, or the influence of the obsessions or the underlying patterns. There is no view of self apart from that, which is why it's changing, because we see the kind of scale of the underlying patterns changing. I mean, we do not build a view of self on the wholesome. Views of self are built upon the anusyas. The I am is not built upon the wholesome. This kind of can be a useful clue. When we hear that in our narrative, you know, I am this or I am that, what is that being built upon? That is a distorted perception, because I am can never be that fragment, such a fragment of experience.
Even what we come to view as a positive of our self,
if it's clinging, it is still an anusya. Yeah.
So the idea of I am kind is distortion versus I'm aware that kindness is a right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you just posed the question a little while ago, the interesting thing is to notice what the view of self is in the absence of anusyas.
Yes.
Of course, the paradox.
Yes, because you know, you would probably look very hard to find a view of self in the absence of the anusyas, which is really quite a revelation.
You're teasing us.
Yeah, yeah, which is actually quite a revelation, because we also have part of distorted perception, and as I just alluded to it a moment ago, is to seize upon a fragment and mistake that fragment for being lasting, continuous, prominent and authoritative. So we actually hardly even know, because in the grip of that distorted perception, we actually don't even notice the moments in the day where there's non-self, where there's non-clinging, because the distorted perception almost becomes this background view which actually makes perception so selective, so we don't even actually attend or really are touched by all the many, many moments in the day where there is non-clinging, non-selfing, and no anusyas in play.
The practice extends those periods.
Extends those periods and actually makes us actually, yes, and sees the transition actually from, you can almost call it from contractedness to spaciousness, from closedness to openness, to
finite.
From finite to infinite. Yes, almost beginning to have a different sense of those in a single day. I mean, there, you know, I think we would die of exhaustion if we spent every minute of our day in the grip of the anusyas. I mean, which is sometimes why we are so exhausted, because actually a lot of moments in the day when they're happening. But I often go back to brushing teeth, because I think it's just the classic example, you know, that the non-self toothbrushing event. That we don't notice. But we don't notice, because the idea is there, and that's almost that conceit of self. The idea is there that somehow I am always in control, I am always doing, I am always, acting, I am always centralized in all things. Which actually, that's a lot of times not happening. That's the good news. And actually we also take the clues from the good news, those moments, to actually really become more sensitized to those moments of moving to the finite through distorted perception. You know, Wittgenstein once said that words deliver us a picture and the picture holds us captive. That's what perception does. Perception delivers us a picture and the picture holds us captive. How much we get held captive by the perceptions, the distorted perceptions that remain unquestioned. Among my early teachers, Manindraji, I think he actually said this to a lot of us. It was probably one of his catchphrases. He said, "The thought of your mother is not your mother." The thought of your mother is not your mother. And we could expand on that. The thought of myself is not myself. You know, the thought of you or the perception of you is not who you are. It's distorted. Yes, please.
Somebody over here mentioned the second foundation of mindfulness.
The second noble truth. Yeah. Sorry, 90% of the time. 90% of the time, not 100% of the time. I mean, I think that the Buddha very clearly recognized, you know, not everything is an internal construction. You know, if somebody came in here and went through the room kicking us all, we would probably agree that physical pain, is unpleasant. If we were all very ill, we would probably agree that illness is not just an internal fabrication. We are ill. So there's a percentage of experience, of Vedana, feeling tone experience, which is actually not internally generated. It is simply objective. It's mostly in the physical realm. You know, it's mostly in the physical realm. The only domain in the emotional psychological realm where it's actually acknowledged to be universal and not a fabrication is grief. It's grief. The rest of it is part of distorted perception. you know, if I stroke my hand, it feels quite pleasant, and it's very easy for me to think, well, that's a really pleasant thing to be happening, you know, just keep stroking. If I sat down in the bus and a stranger did that to me, it would probably be unpleasant. So that's part of that distortion that says, you know, it's intrinsically pleasant, or that's intrinsically unpleasant. Absolutely. Absolutely. Distorted perceptions can, of course, walk right through the door of those experiences that are objectively unpleasant. You know, why is this illness happening to me? What have I done wrong to deserve this? You know, it's immediately moved from attending to what is unpleasant and painful to the distortion of what is unpleasant and painful. The same can happen with grief, of course it can. But it doesn't start there. It doesn't start there. And what you actually see when distorted perception comes in is that it compounds the suffering that is there. Yeah. Yes, please. Absolutely. Okay, so the question is, you know, this can seem complex, although it's not actually complex, but it seems complex because it happens so quickly. So the question is really, can we intervene in that, the rapidity of this unfolding, and relating to what I was talking about yesterday, when I talked about the two kinds of thought, you know, and is that a valid way of kind of beginning to interrupt this process? And yes, it is, you know. I mean, I think this path is lovely in that it offers us a lot of different avenues for interrupting the process of constructing suffering. And one of them is to be able to pause and just ask ourselves, relating to yesterday, is this helpful or unhelpful? You know, does this lead to affliction or does this lead to the end of affliction? You know, does this lead towards freedom or does this lead away from freedom? We could actually bring those questions for sure to every manifestation of papancha, because papancha is almost like the visible face of the anusyas, of the underlying tendencies. You know, that's where we get a sense of where, how those obsessions that we lie down with, how they're operating. It's almost like they get a language. The underlying tendencies get a language, and they get a language in the papancha, in the proliferation. And we start to recognize the tone of the language, you know? We start to recognize the tone. Oh, the language there is one of aversion, or the language there is one of lust, or the language there is one of doubt. And that's when you indeed could bring in that question, where does this go? You know, does this lead to affliction or does it lead to the end of affliction? You know, does it lead to freedom or does it lead to contractedness? That's when you can, I mean, that is a genuine moment of pause, you know? It's a genuine moment of kind of stepping back from the enchantment and the identification, saying, ah, let me find a few key questions that I can bring into a process that feels so dense and so quick. Let me, you know, become intimate with those questions, get them in your bones, you know, write them on your fridge, you know, put them by your phone, you know, make them your screensaver, you know. Does this lead to my affliction and the affliction of others, or does it lead to the end of affliction? We learn to build those reminders into our days, not just into our formal practice.